This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
And then one night we went out to the pub afterwards and we're all sitting around talking about what our dads did. And since we were all in marketing, most of our dads worked in marketing. And then the discussion got around to Andy, and Andy's like, my dad used to be a spy.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to firsthand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Werner Stiller's spectacular defection to the West in 1979 inflicted one of the Cold War's most serious blows to the Stasi. At the time he was working as a case officer for the Main Directorate for Reconnaissance, the Stasi's Foreign Intelligence Division, where he was in charge of scientific espionage in the West. We speak with Stiller's son, Andy, who, although he was 11 months old at the time of his father's defection, met his father in later life. Also included in this interview is Scott Calanico, who is producing a documentary film with Andy, covering his father's abandonment of his family and his country, as well as the story of a young man in his journey to discover the man who was his father, the spy. If you are enjoying the podcast, please leave a written review in Apple Podcasts or share us on social media. You can really help us get new guests. If you can spare it, I'm also asking listeners to contribute at least $3 per month to help keep us on the air. Larger amounts are always welcome. And you get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. We welcome filmmaker Scott Calanico and Andy to our Cold War conversation. Andy has a rather interesting father, who we will move on to in a while. And Scott is a filmmaker who stumbled across this story really by chance.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. Yeah, sure. Basically, I came over to the UK about 10 years ago to go to graduate school in journalism. And after I graduated, I, of course, needed a job. So I wound up working in the computer software field, which is where I'd worked before. So I'd gotten a job with a company up in Scotland. And after I'd been there a couple of years, we hired a German sales representative, which turned out to be Andy. And when Andy started, he was actually directly across from me. So I could hear him talking on the phone all day in German. And I was like, oh, I remember, you know, more German than I thought. And then we all started playing football. Andy might have a different recollection. This is my recollection of it. And then one night we went out to the pub afterwards and we're all sitting around talking about what our dads did. And since we were all in marketing, most of our dads worked in marketing. And then the discussion got around to Andy, and Andy's like, my dad used to be a spy. And I just had to stop the conversation right there. And this was like, all right, hold on, wait a minute. Let's go back to that. And Andy started telling me the story, and that's how I found out about it.
Wow. Wow. And Andy, had you told many other people that your dad was a spy?
Probably not since we were back in Scotland. No. Only, say, close friends. And I don't even know why it came up. You mentioned that we were talking about dads. It was something in relation to that. Yeah. And I remember we might had one or two beers. And somehow I started talking about it. And I remember you took immediate interest in the story. And you actually started, you know, your research capacity came fully blown out. Yeah. You started digging into it. So, yeah. Not many.
And your dad wasn't really any spy. I mean, he was working for the East German Intelligence Services, which people will know as the Stasi. Scott, I can imagine your interest was massively piqued by that. Well, even if Andy's dad had been working for the BND, the West German Intelligence Service, you would have been interested. But East German Intelligence Services, possibly more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that was, of course, when I first heard the story, I was just like, oh, your dad's a spy, crazy, you know. But then as I looked into it, like then, as Andy said, I started doing some research and I didn't realize how big of a spy he was. I mean, he was big in the States. You know, he was when he defected, it was national news. So it was a big deal. And then, yeah, as I read more about it, he wasn't just kind of the run-of-the-mill Stasi. He worked for the HVA, Hauptverwaltung Aufklärung. And so he was in the Foreign Intelligence Service of the Stasi. He wasn't like the dig-through-the-garbage guys or spy on your neighbors. He was an actual spy in the science and technology division.
Right, right. And this was Marcus Wolf's area, yeah, as well,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Marcus, we can come back to that later, but there's a bit
story
of a
itself.
We've got a lot to cover here. Yeah. Andy, did your father have a cover job for this, or did the family know that he was worked for the Stasi?
No, the family didn't know. The Stasi proclaimed that my mom must have had some sort of knowledge, but to the day today, my mom maintains she never knew what he was up to. So he worked in a science party. I think he worked for the university partially. His background was physics. So he studied physics and he worked in that area. And East Germany was different. You know, people tend to, in certain areas, work long hours in certain areas, certainly in the science community. And he easily found excuses for his, you know, being away. You know, these days, I think it would stick more out if someone would have a separate, you know, flat and is away in the evenings. But in East Germany at the time, it didn't really stick out, no.
Right. And what did your mother do? Did your mother work as well?
My mom did indeed, yeah. She's a biochemist, so she worked in the biochemistry field. So, yeah.
Scott, Andy's father's role within the Stasi involved travel to the West as well, I believe.
He went over a couple times. He went over for one of the World Cup championships. You know, he told me about that, and then I read about it. And I think that was the main thing that he'd really done. He was mostly traveling around in the East a lot. Like, he would go to Helsinki, he'd go to Budapest a lot, and other kind of Eastern Bloc countries. But yeah, he went to the West a couple times. He was allowed to go over there, and as long as he came back, of course.
Right, right. And what was his motivation for working for the BND? What changed his mind?
Well, I mean, I guess both. Yeah, Andy, you go.
Well, no, I'm interested in both of your answers. And Andy, you go first.
Yeah. Well, there are two stories to that. And my father always jumped from one to the other and then backwards. So one motivation he had was, which he proclaimed, that he was unsatisfied and unhappy with the system. He eventually thought communism doesn't work the way it should. And the restriction of freedom and restriction of movement. There's another story to it, and my father was quite an adventurer. He got easily bored, and I think the adventure of being a spy, but then obviously, you know, working for another agency was part of it, the thrill, the kick he got out of it. Certainly it wasn't, you know, it's like you changing a job, you know, there are not a lot of consequences, but being a spy and then suddenly turning and working for a different agency, there's a little bit more involved and a little bit more risk involved. And I think the risk, the thrill, was partly part of it as well.
Right. Scott, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll have to agree with Andy. There's probably a lot of factors there. Yeah, what's really interesting is how his dad was pretty much, you know, played by the book, played by the role he was given to. Like, he was like the party secretary, I think, when he was working at the Stasi. So he'd go around and collect everyone's dues. So he was, you know, as far as the system was concerned, he was top notch, you know. Yeah, but I think, like Andy's pointed out, like Werner got recruited out of college. Like, he was approached by the Stasi while he was still at Karl Marx University. And so he got, that was basically the only job he had that he knew of, you know? So he was actually almost 10 years, right, Andy? It was like,
Yeah.
So, you know, I could see him getting bored and then maybe looking for something a little different.
Yeah, do you remember, Scotty, there's one incident which he's describing in one of the documentaries, is he actually worked closely with another colleague who got promoted ahead of him.
Right.
And I think that was one of the things he didn't understand, because he was a quite driven man, a very intelligent man. And, you know, from what I know, the other person who got a promotion above him wasn't as bright, perhaps, or so he might have taken it personal as well. So it's a combination of factors, I would say.
Yeah, and that's interesting, because that's a common thread you see amongst other agents who decide to work for the other side, that being certainly being overlooked in terms of promotion. I think that was one of Aldrich Ames's motivations for him working for the Soviets, but we're not here to talk about him. We're here to talk about your father. Now, I understand there was another woman involved as well.
Indeed. I think it is well known that my father was quite keen on the other gender, and there've been a few accidents, even though he was married to my mom. I think there were three girlfriends, and there was one particular girlfriend where he suddenly saw that opportunity to the other side. We might start talking a little bit more about later, but during the affair, it turned out that the brother of that lady was indeed working in the West, and my father in that moment saw the opportunity, the contact. I think that where the first approach is actually to get in contact with the BND. But yeah, you're probably talking about that woman now.
Right, yeah. Right. Because I think the Stasi weren't too keen on extramarital affairs, were they?
Well, obviously, it's always the same with a system. Like, what you preach and what you do are often two different things. No. Having affairs outside the marriage is probably not really the concept of we are all brothers and sisters working together, but a lot of people actually had affairs. I think East Germany, in opposite to West Germany, was very liberal if it came to sexuality, you know, all this nudist beaches. And I think there was a high level of tasting outside marriage, and my father was certainly one of these candidates who really enjoyed that.
Right.
Yeah, and I was just gonna say, yeah, that's actually in part of his files somewhere, the part that Andy can get to, not the part that I've seen, but his superiors were knew about what was going on, and they were telling him to, you know, mind his manners, watch his P's and Q's, and that was maybe what was, you know, kind of frustrating to him as well.
Right.
You need to see, as a matter of fact, we mentioned that my father traveled majorly the East Bloc, and in some sort of way, he had a bit of leverage where he could go. So he used these travels to poach people of interest to work for the Stasi or to reveal information. And that usually included either alcohol or women or both together, as well as part of the whole poaching an individual. So, you know, his superiors were certainly had knowledge of, you know, in certain areas that it wasn't always the perfect marriage. Yeah,
but presumably they were quite pleased with his overall performance in the job, though, at this point.
Absolutely. He was actually quite successful in both poaching people to real information, then getting valuable information. One of his core interests were nuclear science. Obviously, East Germany was far behind in terms of nuclear science than West Germany was. So that was a great interest. And he made, as it was revealed when he defected, and he unraveled this wave of people getting arrested, he got quite high figures within the industry in West Germany to real information. So yes, he was successful. You got the result.
Right. So prior to meeting this woman who had a brother in West Germany?
It was a brother, yeah.
Right. He hadn't made contact with the BND.
Not that I'm aware of. Scotty, you might have seen something different in notes, but no.
He said he'd tried, but he didn't know what he was doing. The quote, I think he told me, he was like, I was stupid, I didn't know what I was doing. So, this was the first successful one.
His first attempt was quite risky as well. I mean, he was he already must have made the decision for himself he wants it, because, you know, going via your girlfriend or your affair to then get information out that you want to have contact with your BND, that's quite risky. That's, you know, that could have turned around quickly against him. And as we all know, East Germany, why was the Stasi so powerful? Because they had ears everywhere. They turned the normal person, your neighbor, into an ear, into a listening device. So she could have easily worked with the Stasi as well. Who knows? That could have been the end of him, even trying to convince her to get in contact with her brother. But then my father has this incredible skill. Women love him, or loved him. They just love him. So, yeah, risky.
Yeah. But I think to be an agent, you've got to be good at working with people and getting their confidence and being able to influence them. And that does come across, I think, in so many accounts that I've read of some of these agents, is that you've got to be great people.
Yeah.
People, if you see what I mean.
Absolutely. And that what my father absolutely was, that he was a people. He started obviously in his second career as a salesman in banking, and he was very successful. And the reason why he was very successful, he was a people person, and he knew how to speak to someone, and he knew, you know, how to engage. Was his asset. So certainly.
Yeah, and you knew what buttons to press to get somebody to do the bidding. Because I did read somewhere that a lot of former Stasi officers had worked as salespeople once the wall came down. And you can see how they could, you know, almost transfer some of those skills over to becoming good salespeople. And your father's a great illustration with his further life in the West. But we'll come on to that in a moment. So, Scott, how was Werner communicating with the BND from East Germany?
Yeah, no, this is kind of the cool spy part where there were a lot of dead drops. They were doing letter exchanges in Volkspark, Friedrichshain in East Berlin, and there's a whole bit where they were hiding stuff underneath a log, and him and Helga, his mistress at the time, and she would help him decode the messages, you know, and the whole listening to the numbered sequences on the radio. And then they were also passing stuff at moving dead drops through trains. They would go to the hop on a train at a train station in the east, and they'd hide the packages up in the bathroom, like in the bathroom of the train compartment. So the train would go through to the west, and they'd pick up the packages there. So it's like all the crazy, you know, spy top secret stuff that you heard about is real.
And what was he passing over? Was he passing over details of who he was running in the west, or was he passing over other information?
I don't know exactly what he was passing over. I'm just thinking probably just internal documents. They were also – the BND, I think, was giving him stuff to kind of pass back, so he could kind of say that he got this stuff, this information out of them as well. But specifics, I don't know. It was mostly technical documents that he was working on.
It was, I mean, the process didn't go over years and centuries. It was actually not a long period communication with the BND. Initially, it was, the BND was very careful who they're dealing with. And what they wanted is proof of information, like proof of the potential of information he could deliver. So that was the initial internal documents, internal processes. He did not reveal assets in the West at that stage. So he didn't drop the bomb. It was more like the BND were asking for certain information to verify he is indeed what he is. Because obviously another game of the Stasi was placing agents in the West, making them believe it's a defector, and while they're not. So the BND was quite careful as well. And my father was careful, obviously. If you give everything you have immediately, you know, where's the point of working with you? So he certainly was holding back information as well to get that step into the West.
Yeah, that's his sales technique already, working away.
Keep marketing and keep them waiting.
Again, he was a very smart man, and he was always very, he was maybe a bit clumsy at the end, but he certainly wasn't clumsy in the beginning. I remember a story he told me that was part of his recruitment process or his education, and there were final tests, and one of these final tests was him being tasked to retrieve a package from the west side, so to step over the border and to retrieve information and then to come back. But the test was actually to let someone loose into the west. You know, you're over the border, there is no one with a pistol anymore, you could just run for it. And he was on the other side, and so certainly that went through his head. But what he actually saw on the way was a package, a cigarette package. I think it was a Russian brand, could have been East German, maybe East German, but it's certainly an East brand. And the moment you saw that cigarette package, he was fully aware that he is still in the East sector and not in the West, and that test. So he was very good with reading his surroundings, with reading people, and very smart. So, and obviously he came back, and it was was counted as a success. Yeah, you know,
that's a clever trick. I hadn't heard that before. Yeah.
That's in there's a made for TV movie that they did in Germany, Der Rote Jackal. And
Jokal,
all right, yeah, there it was. So he's gonna get my German right. I think that was from 95, 96, but they do that scene. It's a drama, and they do that scene. That's right. How the movie starts off. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I'll have to watch out for that, even with my limited German. But the Stasi get on his trail, don't they? Or on Helga's trail.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Yeah, Helga was a mistress, and they start because they were doing they were mailing letters to the West to safe houses of the West, and the Stasi was able to start picking up on the because they're opening up the mail and looking through and finding the secret writing and stuff like that, and so they were able to start pinpointing where these letters were coming from.
Which was in itself a difficult task. It sounds easy with the technology we have these days, but because there were post boxes all over Berlin, and he was obviously living in Berlin, acting from Berlin, there were so many post boxes, it was impossible to really pin it down as a movement. It might come later in a minute, but one of the fatal mistakes was actually posting a letter from the outskirts of Berlin and getting into Russian control. And that was one of the parts where it suddenly became, where the game changer, where it suddenly was out of his hand.
And did he know that they were on his trail? Because he arranged exfiltration, didn't he, for him and Helga?
Yes, but he knew. It was, at the end, was actually quite close. So as I just mentioned, he acted mostly from Berlin, but he was on the outskirts of Berlin on a romantic trip, and they were dropping off a letter in the letterbox outside of Berlin, and then they had intercourse, and they got stopped or got interrupted by a Russian control, and the Russian control took the details, and that was the moment. The letter, obviously posted from the outskirts of Berlin, got intercepted with the writing. But also the record file, somehow, it was just a matter of time. My father knew it would make it into the center, and that would tie him in. And that's where time was suddenly start running against them.
Right. So he then organizes with the BND exfiltration, but I think that plan changes at the last minute for him because he's in the Stasi HQ in Normannenstrasse trying to get files. And Scott, do you want to just give a bit more detail on that?
Yeah, I mean, before Andy will help me out with this too, but he'd been, first of all, the BND didn't want him to leave, you know, when you have a double agent, you don't want them to leave their inside source because they just want to get information. So they were trying to convince him to stay. And eventually he was like, no, I got to get out of here. So they wound up getting him a passport so he could come through to the West and wound up having the wrong eye color on the passport. Yeah. So he couldn't, you know, it was useless.
It was very clumsy. Yeah. He actually many times referred to that period of time as a little bit of a shock, how clumsy the BND acted. It was a passport with the wrong eye color. There was also an incident with a train where he was meant to go onto a train. It was running through East Germany. And he was supposed to get on a train, but unfortunately the station he was meant to go on, it wasn't a stop. So the train just passed him while he was at the station. So there were a few errors, but certainly the wrong passport was a big one. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the first kind of attempt. And then the second one you're speaking about the headquarters on Normannstrasse was he knew it was time to go. I mean, I'm sure Andy of course will jump in here, but he knew it was time to go. So, but he also knew he needed to bring something with him. So he went back to the headquarters on Normannstrasse, broke into his supervisor's office, forged himself the pass that he needed to get through at Friedrichstrasse to get to the West. And then while he was there, he broke open a cabinet containing a bunch of microfilm and just dumped it all as much as he could into his briefcase and then walked out the door with that.
And I think he tried to get into his boss's files as well, but was unable to get into those.
That was his first attempt. He was in his boss's office, and he couldn't open the fortified steel cabinet. But he then had an attempt on the secretary's file cabinet, and he managed. And there were certainly enough information in there that was valued for him to take. So he had a briefcase full of very sensitive explosive material. Yeah, and a pistol.
Okay, and then he drives to Friedrichstrasse, which I think is about 20-25 minutes from Normannenstrasse at the time of day that he was trying to cross. But there is a when he gets there is a bit of a hold up for him at the border as well.
Yeah, he goes in through the secret entrance at Friedrichstrasse, which I always try to find. Every time I'm in there, I try to look for it. People, we had a tour guy said it's across from the Etika. So if you're ever in Friedrichstrasse, look for that. But so he went through the secret door that they could go into the West and do dead drops and stuff in the lockers there and also take the U-Bahn and the S-Bahn out. So he went to the other side and he's going through the last door, and he gets and there's the guard desk there, and he presents this forged passport, you know, pass that he's made for himself, and the guard kind of looks it over and is like, well, this, you know, this is the wrong form, or it was expired or something.
Expired.
Wow.
They used a new form which he wasn't aware of. Yeah.
And he kind of talked his way out. Well, I think the phrase he said, "Mein Sekretär ist ein bisschen doof." Or my secretary is a little dumb.
A bit stupid. Yeah.
And so convince the guard, and the guard, you know, presses the buzzer, the door opens, and it opens right onto the track. It's the U6 in the basement of Friedrichstrasse. And I remember that, like, you know, in that book he wrote, and when he mentioned, talked about the escape, he just said that was like the longest, you know, 7 minutes of his life, because he had to sit there on the platform waiting for the next train to come through before he could, you know, be in the West.
Mm. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, the nerve to be able to talk your way through the fact you've got expired documents on, you know, the last gate to be able to get to the West sort of shows his, I guess, persuasive manner and what, you know, what he was capable of in a tight situation. I mean, that's incredible. I guess that that guard didn't have much of a career.
Yeah, after that. I'm always curious as to what happened to that guy.
So, from my father's perspective, there wasn't another chance. He was too fine. I mean, not only, obviously, he revealed information to the West, which was pretty much a death sentence anyway. He then obviously opened the file cabinet. There was no way of returning.
Yeah.
He was dead by that point, and he knew that. He had a gun with him. And I asked him, he said he would have used the gun. If it would have come to a showdown, he would have used it, because there was no way for out for him. Death sentence was already there. His only way was trying to get out, no matter what.
Yeah, no, incredible. I mean, I think I've seen a video on YouTube, which is a recreation of his encounter with that guard.
Yeah, that's in a couple of, there's a couple of German TV documentaries where they redid that scene.
Yeah. Yeah. So the U-Bahn arrives, and so where does he go to in West Berlin?
Well, the interesting thing about the U-Bahn is that, so this is the U-Bahn going to West Berlin, and they had any station that was close to the wall, the East Germans would shut up. They would, they literally brick over the surface and lock it down. These were the ghost stations, Geisterbahnhof. And so the train still had to go through like two of the U-Bahn had to go through like two of those before it got to the West. And every time it goes through one of those stations, the train slows down and you can see the guards, like East German border guards on the platform with guns, just watching to make sure nobody hops out of the train. And so we had to go through a couple of those stations before he was free. So then, doing all the escape and then having to go through that was pretty nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I remember riding through those when I was in Berlin before the wall came down, and I used to actually make a point of traveling those lines with the ghost stations, because it was just so weird. You were taking the underground train to another country, or you were underneath another country. I mean, it was crazy. So where did he know where to go or who to call once he got to West Berlin?
He knew where to go. Let's put it that way. Unless Andy knows something that I don't.
Well, he ended up at the police station, and they didn't know what to do with him.
Yeah.
Because he revealed himself as a defector. I don't know which police station it was. Scott, you might.
Yeah, it's the one, this is kind of where it takes a comical turn, is that, so he gets out of the U-Bahn. He takes a taxi to Tegel. We're gonna miss you, Tegel. But he takes a taxi to Tegel. He finds he was gonna fly to Munich, which is where the BND headquarters was. But he finds out he missed the last plane. So that's when he turns himself to the airport police.
Yeah.
And the airport police don't know what to do with him. They're sitting around eating cake. They invite him to have cake. And then the airport police, because that was in the French sector, they call the French military police. And then the French military police show up, but none of them speak German fluently enough to handle the situation. So then they have to call in more people. So eventually they get somebody in there that says, you're okay, you're safe, we got you.
Yeah, because at that point, obviously, West Berlin was an occupied territory by the British, the French, and the Americans. And Tegel, as you say, was in the French sector. Okay, and then presumably he is flown to Pulach, the headquarters of the BND.
Yeah, he's flown there and then kind of debriefed, and then they keep him. The BND keeps him in Europe for a few months because they want his help with various operations.
Right. And how much damage did he do to the Stasi, do you think?
A lot. There are two kinds of damages. One are the West assets they lost. There was a big wave of arrests next day made throughout West Germany. Actually, as a matter of fact, one of the people who went to jail, his daughter, who was the same age as my sister at the time when my father defected, they wrote a book together about these experiences they both had, losing their fathers in one go on one thing, the whole spy scenario. But there were a few, and it's like a lot of information. But I think, and Scotty will tell you probably a bit more about it, the biggest hit they gave to East Germany was revealing who Marcus Wolf, giving him a face. Because for the West side, obviously they knew who Marcus Wolf, Misha is, but they didn't have a face. They didn't know who that individual is. And my father could point him out on photographs and put a face to a man. And the Stasi never took that well. And obviously, Marcus Wolf and Erich Mielke, they hated him for him. They hated him to guts. They wanted him dead, no matter what. I think the initial sum they offered for his head was a million. Was it dollars or Easter? It was a million as a figure, as a little bit of an encouragement to get him done.
Right. And one of the things that really surprised me about this story is the courier who was the BND courier for him was also working for the Stasi.
Yeah, I did not know that.
Yeah, no, I was really surprised by this. But apparently he wasn't working on ideological reasons. He was working for monetary reasons and so kept the two jobs completely compartmentalized.
Oh,
and was basically okay. Earning from both intelligence agencies.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll double check over that. Ian, thanks for the pages.
Yeah, well, that's okay. You can include that in the film where we get a little credit there for... no, I'm only joking. So he's helping the BND on various operations and presumably, you know, helping them roll up his network of spies that he had in the West. What was it? Have you any idea what his deepest penetration agent was that he had in the West? Who was the most influential agent he had?
I know he had somebody that was working at IBM that was pretty up there. That was like the big deal. And then there was a couple of the scientists, is it Karlsruhe, wherever they had the big nuclear facility in the West. Those were kind of the big ones.
Right.
That he was responsible for. The IBM thing was interesting because that was the whole time when the, you know, the East Germans were stealing as much as they could about computers so they could start building their own computer.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Robotron was not up to much, up to the standard.
No.
So once the BND have basically got as much intelligence information out of him as they possibly can, what happens to him then? Because presumably the Stasi are still like trying to find him.
Yeah, I mean, Andy can pick up. I just want to have this one story that I remember. Actually, I think it was in that Christie book, was that he, at one point, he decided he wanted to go windsurfing in some lake in around Munich. And so he ditched his bodyguards and was windsurfing on the lake and chatting up some woman who was hanging out on the beach, and they finally caught up with her. Like, you can't do this, you know, people want you dead. So they knew they had to get him out of Germany or out of Western Germany, out of the continent, you know. So they brought him up to the CIA. Yeah.
There was actually quite a tough period because obviously they were quite restricted in movements. And by the time they had Helga out as well. So now he had to spend time with Helga. And that's where the relationship started to crumble between the two. But it wasn't certainly the fun period he was looking for, that freedom, because now obviously he was detained again. He couldn't move. He was restricted in his movements and who he could talk to. So,
I mean, Helga basically says that, like, she knew as soon as she met him again after the defection, they were, he got what he needed out of her, and they were nice friends now, and that was it.
He pretty much used her,
yeah. And what was the impact on your mother and your sister as well, and the rest of the family?
Huge. For me, I was 11 months old, so for me there wasn't an immediate impact at all, but it was hard for my sister. My sister was 7 at the time. And obviously my mother, she did not expect that. So you must imagine, you know, you have your family, and although it wasn't a perfect marriage, you know, you have a husband, and suddenly from one day to the other, a couple of men standing in front of your door and asking where your husband is. and accusing of you being a traitor to the country. That really knocked my mom out. And then there were repercussions after this. We needed to leave Berlin. The family needed to settle down somewhere else. My mom got a few towns she was allowed to go to, and she had to choose where to, and then we had to leave Berlin. So my sister had to go out of school, complete new environment. My mother had to go into complete new environment without friends. And it's been difficult for my mom. And anyway, my mom is Hungarian. So she left Hungary for my father to live with him in Berlin, which went okay for a while. But then suddenly having to move again to somewhere else with no friends and no family. So she wasn't allowed to have any contact to his side of the family. And we did not. And I tell you what, you know, until I was 11, I did not know this story. I heard all about this when the war came down. I had no clue. Like when I asked for, you know, obviously I was aware there must have been a male part to the whole situation. At one age, you start asking, who's your father? But the only thing I got was, your father was a bad man. He left us. And that was it. And I didn't even see any pictures of him, any photographs. It was all hidden away. Until the war came down. And that was a big revelation for me. And my sister, I think even today, it's still a thorn in her heart, this betrayal, being left by your own father. And that took her heart.
Well, I can't understand that, but I can see that whole betrayal of the whole family of, you know, his country at that time. Mm. But, you know, I can understand the reasons for the ideological betrayal, but obviously the impact on the family is huge. And when you say you were told when the wall came down, I mean, how were you told? Did your mum just sit you down and say, I need to tell you a bit more about your father?
No, it wasn't that straightforward. So how did that end up? So my mom got remarried in the time anyway, so she had a husband at the time when the war came down. So I was all a little bit curious. But my father got in touch with his side of the family when the war came down, when it was safe for him to do so, reconnecting with his mother and his sisters. But he was also curious of obviously getting in contact with my mom, sort of. And my mom got then contact to that family, his side of the family again. And there was an arranged meetup in Frankfurt, where he lived at the time, in West Frankfurt, Frankfurt am Main. And we all drove to Frankfurt to meet him. That's when I met him the first. But no one bothered to tell me that is actually my father. So I've been told it's a family friend in the West side, which was quite funny because we didn't have friends in the West side, as far as I was aware. But there was a second thing to it as well. We actually met his family, my grandmother, but no one told me that's my grandmother either. So there was another story I've been told why we were seeing these people. But at the end of the day, I actually knew who's my grandmother before I knew who's my father. When was actually the moment I knew it was my father? We were sitting together as a family, and I think I guessed it because that mother, who was my grandfather, knew the man we were visiting in Frankfurt. So it all came together. But I knew something was there anyway when I met my father the first time. Meeting this man, it's hard to explain. He was familiar immediately. And he was close immediately. He wasn't a stranger when I met him.
In his mannerism, or you could just tell that there was some connection there?
I could just tell. There was a connection. Some connections are hard to explain.
Yeah.
Some bonds are hard to explain. And it was this immediate. It partially probably was sort of being stunned as well, because, you know, the man I met when I was 11 living in the West was that big successful banker. He drove off there with his Porsche. Everything around him was just very eloquent, very sophisticated. And he took me into his bank building. We took the elevator up to the top floor and his big office. But it's also the way how he interacted with me, spoke, was very, you know, he was just not a stranger when I met him. Yeah. There was something.
Yeah. Yeah, because he'd had, I mean, you know, after his defection, he'd then gone to, Scott, he'd worked in the US, hadn't he? And then had returned to Germany and worked in Frankfurt.
Yeah, he'd gone to, actually, the CIA gave him a new identity when they brought him to the States and then became Peter Fisher. And then his story is that they gave him a choice of where he could go to graduate school, because that's what he wanted to do, and study business. And he said he'd never seen the Mississippi, so he wanted to go to graduate school in St. Louis. So he went to graduate school there, got his MBA, made friends, was a popular guy. And then his professors helped him get a job at Goldman Sachs on Wall Street after he graduated.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he says he thinks the CIA might have had something to do with that as well.
Yeah, because obviously when he is in the recruiting recruiting process, there was a long break in his CV, and obviously the hiring personnel there in Goldman was curious about his age and the gap in his CV. I don't even know how you excuse that.
There's a funny story. I think one of your dad's friends told that story. It was like, I can't remember how the whole, but basically it was the same thing. It was somebody had seen his CV, but like it was a fake CV. We have, I think it's in that Christie book, or one of these books, they actually have his fake CV where he said he worked in Frankfurt on Oder and all this other stuff. And then so the recruiter was looking at that fake CV and he was like, oh, that looks okay. And then somebody just mentioned, yeah, wait till you see his real CV.
yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Wow. And, you know, did your, I presume your mother kept a distance from him, you know, subsequently, you know, he let you and your sister see him? And
there was an agreement. So my mom made it perfectly clear. If you hurt my kids again, I kill you. So he agreed for him to meet us again, under the promise that he's not hurting us again. But you know, but you must see, my father was a big love. My father, yeah, she loved him. And although the marriage weren't perfect, when she met him again, there was this Werner Stiller again, that charming man who, you know, who has this ability to just get people to follow him. And I think over the years, like, we had fantastic family parties. It wasn't like my mom and my father, whenever we came together, started, you know, arguing. No, we had actually great parties afterwards and the family coming together. And obviously we spent a little bit more time then with my father's family again there. And my father even came with us to Hungary again. My grandparents, my late grandparents lived outside from Budapest, outside, a bit further out in Jászberény. And my grandmother just loved my father. Obviously, story of his life. she was like, you know, and as soon as he arrived in Budapest to re-meet my grandparents, he was a favorite again. Everything was forgiven. That was the kind of person. He could, there was no wrongdoing for him. People just, well, eventually there was. But,
No, incredible story. And Scott, you spoke with Andy's dad on the phone. I mean, that must have been pretty amazing to you know, to speak to the man himself.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was just cool. I was just running around. I get to interview a spy. You know, that was pretty exciting. And the funny thing is, I had the audio levels all screwed up on my recorder, so he actually sounds very crackly and not very good, but it kind of fits for some reason. But yeah, Andy put me in contact with Werner, and so we had two conversations. The second one I think is better, because by that time I'd actually done my research and like read more about him and what his whole story was. And then we were planning to go down to Budapest to film him in a couple months when, Andy told me, actually Andy told me here in Berlin when we were doing some film, and that his dad had disappeared.
Yeah. Yeah. And can you just tell me a bit more about the circumstances?
Yeah. As spectacular as my father's life was, spectacular was meant to end. My father, tried to commit suicide. So he went AWOL. No one could find him. There was no contact. And he was then, we reported him missing in Hungary. And as a matter of fact, he tried to commit suicide. He was found. They saved his life. He ended up in hospital. He released himself, so we were bound to come down to see him later on, but he early released himself from hospital. So my sister and I, we flew over when we got news that he tried to take his life, and we saw him in hospital, but he wasn't there, he wasn't conscious, and it was really a close call. We had to flew back because I started just a new job in Berlin, and it was actually my first week in a new job. So I could flew down, but I had to come back. And then he released himself. And we had a few conversations when he released himself where I, tried to talk him out of it. But he was set on it. And then he disappeared. And for me, I knew the moment he disappeared, and we haven't heard for a week, that there's probably no good end to it. And eventually in December, they fished him out of the Duna in Hungary, and that was the end of him. What's the reason? Like in life, my father went through many stages in his life, through being a spy, being a successful banker. That ended. He worked then in fashion. He had a franchise in Eastern Europe, a fashion franchise. To every of these stories, there was always something, and we could spin another story. The reason why this franchise business stopped, he fell out with the owners in Prague who built the business, and they changed the model. They wanted upfront payment for the clothes, and my father didn't see the point, so just pretty much took the next delivery of all stores, and we're talking about huge stocks. Just sold it all and disappeared out of the business and left that owner in Prague without any notice or anything. Done. Just, and that's off to the next stage of his life. And he always was very fond of women, of young women, till the end. But I think what came together at the end was the realization that in terms of career, it's done. And in terms of young women, it's not working anymore. And my father always said, if it doesn't work with the women anymore, that's him done. And yeah, he kept his promise.
Yeah, that's a sad end to the story.
It's sad for us. It wasn't sad for him. And you need to see, as much as my father was a people person and he was good with the people, there was a lot of ego. I look at I have a 2-year-old, and I look at my daughter, and when I cuddle her or look in her face, and I even thinking of I would have to leave her, almost gets me tearing up. I can't even think being without her. For him to leaving a whole family, but leaving them, and then there's a new life, and actually being fine with it. It takes a lot of ego, and it takes a lot of being centered of yourself, and then coming back into our life, and as nothing ever happened, you're back there. And that's the biggest thing between my sister and my father, where they never came together. There was no apology. There was no trying to make up for it. It was just, I'm back here, let's get on with it. And that's been him throughout his life, very self-centered.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting insight, Andy, and I really appreciate you you sharing that. Scott, do you want to tell us a little bit about the film?
Yeah, sure. So we, like I said, as I mentioned, Andy kind of told me the story a few years back, and I just been filming him pretty much ever since then. I used to live in Scotland there too, so I'd show up and film Andy and stuff, and this gradually started picking up momentum to the point where we put together a documentary short just because we wanted to be able to tell the story in kind of a short way, be able to see to sell Andy as a main character and just tell an interesting story, you know, that maybe hadn't been told to English speaking people before. So we put together this short and it's called Betrayal, oddly enough, as we've mentioned Betrayal a lot. And we were set to premiere at Tribeca Film Festival this year in New York, but obviously COVID-19 had other ideas for us. But what we wound up doing is we've licensed the film to the New Yorker magazine, and it's going to premiere online as part of their doc series, probably later in the summer or in the fall.
Great. And how easy was it getting, you know, the extra information for the film?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm talking to you from Berlin. One of the reasons I moved here is just also number one, to get away from the Scottish weather. But although, you know, Edinburgh still has a place in my heart, but I needed to be away from the rain. But also I knew I needed to be in Berlin just to kind of, if I was going to know this story, I needed to know the city. And then also put me closer to the Stasi archives, which they've got an amazing amount of material here. So I've been going back and forth there this whole time and digging through the archives and ordering Andy's dad's file and telling Andy to order his dad's file and just digging through all these documents. And so that was great to be able to come here and have access to so much material.
Yeah. And what have you learnt that you didn't know at the start with this project, particularly with digging into the files and some of the, you know, the actual hard evidence of the story?
Yeah. So I shared a couple of these pictures with you. These are the pictures from the file, that after Andy's dad defected, of course, they had they wrote lots of reports. They loved their reports over there. So when Werner went to Friedrichstrasse, he left his car there. And so one of the most interesting things is there's a series of photos of they're taking pictures of everything that was in his car. And there was a bunch of jewelry in there, and he had this bag that was in the trunk. So it looks like he was driving around ready to go at any time. He had a bunch of maps of West Germany in there. He had like 50,000 marks hidden inside a chocolate bar box and just, you know, interesting stuff like that, which I didn't know about. So I guess, you know, like we were saying, he's probably just driving around with everything in his car ready to go just in case. And then the other kind of really interesting thing that I read was there's a report in the file. We talked about in the story where Andy's dad defected, went to the airport at Tegel and had to sit there. Well, there's a report in the file of an IM, a Stasi informant who was working for either the airport police or the Berlin police. So they're in the room when he defected, and they filed this report about this is what happened when he was in the room. He wanted a vodka, so they had to go to the gas station and get him a flask of vodka. And then he kept getting on the phone and he was insisting on calling somebody in West Germany, and nobody was answering. He was getting more agitated, but it was just this fly on the wall report of them telling the Stasi everything he did, this is everything he said, and they had this crazy amount of insight over there. So that was a pretty interesting document to see.
Wow, that's really interesting. Yeah, seeing it from one of the one of the Stasi agents on the inside there. Did you speak to any Stasi officers?
We definitely want to talk to Andy's mom and Andy and Andy's sister. So that was kind of been the main focus right now. But yeah, we'll definitely talk. There's actually one. It's the son of one of the guys that Andy's dad turned in. His son is a tour guide at Hohenschönhausen prison. So we want to talk to him. Mm. And so there's a few over here, but we haven't interviewed any yet, as of yet. Yeah, no.
Wow.
But that's on the books.
Wow. Okay. Is he English speaking?
I don't know. We haven't been in contact with him yet.
Sorry. I'm already looking for other guests.
I'd take over.
I didn't.
How can listeners of the podcast help support you in the production of the film?
Yeah, well, right now we're kind of in the midst of setting up a fundraising page. But right now what they can do is go to my website, scottclonico.com/betrayal was the short. That's what we're calling it. But if you just go to my website, scottclonico.com, you'll see a picture of Andy's dad with a black bar over his eyes. You can click on that. We've got a trailer you can watch, kind of see like a little bit more about the story and some information about the film. And you can go over there, drop us a line, and we'll keep you in contact and let you know. Scottclonico.com is my website.
Great. Well, we'll put that link in the show notes, and we'll also put the trailer in there as well, because I think it gives a really good taste as to what you're trying to produce there. Yeah. So that'll certainly whet the Cold War Conversation listeners' appetites. And we have further photos, videos, and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And if you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where listeners just like you continue the Cold War Conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.